You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. From today's lens, it's hard for some to imagine the United States government tormenting anyone for just singing a song. Certainly not Strange Fruit, Billie Holiday's protest song against lynching. What crime could the United States government possibly find in amplifying the senseless killing of black people, black men specifically, for nothing more than the color of their skin? Why was an entity of the federal government outraged over a now classic American protest song with the lyric, "Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees"? The harsh truth is Jim Crow wasn't just in the South. Racism was all over the nation, and few knew that as well as Billie Holiday. Becoming the iconic Lady Day, beloved by black and white Americans for her talent, did not shield her. No amount of fame could save her from the punishment reserved for her refusal to stop singing Strange Fruit. Unable to outrun her demons, she had turned to drugs to numb the pain of her rough childhood, her unfortunate choice in men, and just the price of living black and female in America. And the government, her government, used her weakness, her drug addiction, against her. This is the subject of a new film by director Lee Daniels called The United States versus Billie Holiday. And today, Lee Daniels joins me on the podcast to talk about his fascination with Lady Day and how the 1971 film Lady Sings the Blues inspired him to go into the movies. He reveals that he always has a personal connection to each of his films, that The United States versus Billie Holiday was the first movie that he's ever directed sober, and how his own struggle with drugs and alcohol gave him insight into Holiday's lifelong addiction. We discuss the famous song that put her in the FBI's crosshairs, the powerful drug agent who was intent on destroying her, and why Lee believes that she deserves a place among America's civil rights heroes. Plus, Lee talks about his upcoming miniseries about another famous black entertainer and civil rights leader, Sammy Davis Jr. Coming up with Academy Award nominee Lee Daniels in just a moment. Lee Daniels is the Academy Award-nominated director and producer of such acclaimed motion pictures as Monsters Ball, Precious, and The Butler, as well as the creator and the executive producer of the hit television series Empire. Now he's exploring a fascinating and underreported aspect of the life of a legendary jazz icon in his new movie, The United States versus Billie Holiday, which streams on Hulu beginning February 26th. Lee Daniels, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on the show. My kids will be very happy
I'm here. Yeah, I can't believe it. They must be the youngest people that listen, I think.
Something's wrong.
Okay. How old are your kids?
25.
Oh, okay. Okay. That's getting a little closer to my demo, I suppose. Well, I loved this movie, Lee. It's a fantastic addition to your canon as a director and as a producer. I'm a longtime fan of Billie Holiday, so I was already kind of predisposed to love this film. Her story has already been told before on screen, though, most notably in the 1971 movie Lady Sings the Blues, which earned Diana Ross an Oscar nod. Some of the people watching this may come to this film saying that the definitive Billie Holiday movie's already been made. Were you at all intimidated by Lady Sings the Blues, and what inspired you to want to take a second look at Lady Day?
I was very intimidated by Lady Sings the Blues. Lady Sings the Blues is the reason why I'm doing what it is that I do. I was a teenager, 13, when I saw that movie in the theater. My grandfather was a manager of a theater in Philadelphia, and I went to see that movie, and I had never seen anything like it before in my life. It was I'd never seen Black people that looked so beautiful. Love story, you know, the humor of Richard Pryor and the beauty of Diana Ross and Billie Dee Williams and the fashion and the hair and the music, and Diana Ross at the height of all of that. Representing Black America, it changed me, you know, because it was Harlem and it was so real, you know. If you study my work, you'll note that all of it's very real. My work is very, very real, and that comes from just those moments of Richard Pryor's brilliant authenticity in the moment and Diana Ross going from glamour to nappy head when she was, you know, without her, you know, when she was being arrested and all that kind of crazy during the drug mess. So yeah, I was nervous. I was so nervous. I called Barry Gordy, who is, you know, creator of the film, producer and Motown chief. I begged him his permission to do the film because it was the Holy Grail for me. So, yeah.
What was that conversation like?
Well, I was presenting him an award in Detroit at Motown, Hitsville, and it was an offstage conversation. And I gave him the award. I had him in a good mood, juiced him up. He was like, "Yeah, man, dude, go for it. Do your thing." But that movie wasn't the real life. You know, that wasn't her. That wasn't the story, man. And not that this is her story. This is not her story. This is not a biopic at all. It's a moment in time. Mm-hmm. It's really a love story, an espionage-y love story, sort of, when you really think about it. And United States versus Billie Holiday, yes, they were after her, but the United States is, that part of it is one of the first Black federal agents that they hired, that Hoover and Anslinger hired to infiltrate Harlem because they couldn't get white men to infiltrate Harlem, to take Billy down for a song, The Strange Fruit song.
Going back to Lady Sings the Blues, I do want to kind of tell listeners that it glosses over a lot. It basically turns, let's be honest, an abusive codependent relationship with her husband, Louis McKay, into a love story. And I think he was actually a consultant in the movie, so he kind of got to write his own story, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah.
He was not a great guy, according to this movie.
Right, and we should have, if we really had listened, if we read Billie Holiday's biography,
memoir. Yeah,
she didn't really write it, but she wrote it with two other people. But she had very much had a hand in it. We would know that Louis McKay was not a good guy necessarily, and which would have made us then question Lady Sings the Blues. Mm-hmm. Yeah, man, he was not a good guy, but. She wasn't attracted to good guys. I think that, you know, when you grow up in a brothel and you don't really know what a good guy is and you are a prostitute at a really early age and you're raped at 10 and you are sent to a reform school because you are raped, you know? Wow. And, you know, and I just think that, you know, her idea of what a good man was.
Right.
Was definitely messed up at birth.
Yeah, Billie Holiday had a string of bad relationships, and obviously, as you alluded to, this very troubled childhood involving rape and sex trafficking. She's often portrayed as sort of this tragic figure with the fatal drug addiction and everything else, but I don't think that I've ever heard her referred to as a civil rights hero. Do you think that she deserves a place among some of the better known celebrity activists like, say, Muhammad Ali, Harry Belafonte, Aretha, Sammy, those guys?
Oh, yeah, for sure. She kicked it off. I believe she kicked it off. Really? She kicked off the civil rights movement as we know it. And I think that that is what attracted me most to the film, because when you think of civil rights leaders, you think of Malcolm X, you think of Martin Luther King. You don't think of Billie Holiday. Mm-hmm. Her legacy is what the government really wanted us to be left with, was this tragic, drug-riddled, brilliant singer. But that was not, that's not the case. She stood up to the government. And I don't know that I could have. I know that if they told me today to stop directing, or your family's out, or we're taking you out, I'd have to seriously give thought to it.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it mirrors some of the decisions that people had to make during the Hollywood blacklist and McCarthyism and all that. And it almost seems absurd today to think that the United States government would be so threatened by this one song. Why did J. Edgar Hoover and all these powerful white men in Washington believe that Strange Fruit was so dangerous? What were they afraid of?
Well, Strange Fruit had to deal with the lynching of black people in the South. And Maripol wrote it, a Jewish man, and he couldn't get anybody to sing it. And so Billy took it on. And it was so powerful. Those words, I didn't even understand what those words meant. When I watched Lady Sings the Blues, all these years, I didn't really understand the significance of those words until I read the script, Susan Laurie Parks' script. And that book was, by the way, based on Johann Hari's Chasing the Scream. I didn't understand what Strange Fruit meant. Even now, as I think of it, black bodies swinging from the southern trees, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. She was an international star as a singer.
Sure,
and white people were catching on to the importance of what that song was about. Mm-hmm. It was okay for black people, for her to sing to black audiences, that song. But white people were standing up and realizing this shit is happening. This is real. And I think that that's what upset them the most. And I think that they had to stop her from reaching that audience to singing that song.
Yeah,
and then right after that, many white people came up during the civil rights movement. A lot of it had to do with that song. It was way before King and everything. And
I looked up the Wikipedia for the song "Strange Fruit," and it actually says that it's widely considered by many people to be the start of the civil rights movement. That song, not just the anthem of the movement, but the start of it. And J. Edgar Hoover, of course, had a well-documented obsession with targeting civil rights leaders. But this movie specifically focuses on a subordinate of Hoover's, Harry Anslinger, who essentially, I guess, started what is now the DEA. And he ran it for 32 years. Very powerful guy under several different presidents. What do you think motivated him?
Well, according to Johann's book, Chasing the Scream, he was a racist. He had watched his neighbor die a bizarre death of an OD. So he was obsessed with drugs. Wow. And so there was a combination of both of those things. And and Billie Holiday was the perfect target for him. And he could not believe that she would not stop singing the song. He asked her nicely in the beginning.
Yeah.
He thought he was doing the grand thing and she blew him off. And,
wow. So he really was obsessed with this song. It wasn't really about drug addiction or busting people for drugs. It was all about the way, why in the world did he care so much about this song? That's what I keep wondering. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, the effect that it had, it was having an effect. And also his he was in charge of Prohibition, and Prohibition ended. And so when Prohibition ended, he shifted gears and focused on the drugs.
Okay, had to keep himself employed, I guess.
He had to keep his his whole posse employed. Yeah. Otherwise, they were closing it. Yeah. But he really circled in on the song.
Yeah, yeah, and apparently he targeted not just Billie Holiday. She's probably the most prominent one, but a number of jazz musicians, and specifically black jazz musicians like Charlie Parker and Miles Davis. And
I think he was also the one. Really.
What's that? Yeah. I looked him up.
Wow.
Apparently, he went after a number of jazz musicians for either marijuana or heroin or whatever. And he's also kind of the person who created the whole reefer madness myth back in the 50s and 40s.
I heard about that. And look, and he also helped Judy Garland when she was having her problem. Like,
really?
He took her to a home and made sure that she was looked after properly.
That's interesting. Well, that's very different treatment than Lady Day got. Well, Anslinger hired this young black agent named Jimmy Fletcher, who you mentioned earlier, to infiltrate Billie Holiday's circle, going undercover and basically entrapping her. But their relationship has a very unexpected arc.
Crazy.
To it. Is that all true?
Yeah, it's all true. I mean, the depth of that truth, I'm not sure, but we do know that they had an affair, and we do know that he fell in love with her. Now, I don't know what happened. I don't think he was there, as I have it. Not that I'm giving away my ending the way I have it drawn out, but there was an affair. And I think he understood that he was doing the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. He went in with a job, and then he realized that he was doing the wrong thing. Mm-hmm. So, but I did make up maybe I shouldn't be telling everybody this, but I made up his mom, because I couldn't find information about Jimmy other than that they were like he came after her and they had an affair, but I couldn't find any information on his background. So I made up the mother as sort of a voice of reason.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think she's a good device also to show that he comes from a very different background than Billie Holiday did.
Yeah,
very different
We do not see black people that are wealthy at all. And it was really important for me to show, you know, that. And also she was a voice of reason too for him. You know, men sort of listen to that. I know I listened to my mom. And,
same here.
And I felt that she also was... she also was a supporter of Billie's, because so often it was written that they were black people were not so nice to her in the press and such. So I really wanted to show that women were supportive of her.
Mm-hmm. And I will say this, it wasn't just made up that she had a drug addiction. She wasn't just being targeted without any evidence. She did actually struggle with addiction to heroin for many, many years. And, you know, in those days we addressed it very differently.
Yes. And I think that when you look at the environment that she was in, she was finding the cure for the pain that she was in, that she couldn't escape. And she was trying to find a cure. People oftentimes look at drug addicts as problemed people, and as, you know, it's a negative connotation, as opposed to looking at people that are just trying to find a cure for the pain that they're in.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was interested to read in a recent interview that you say this was the first movie that you have directed without the influence of drug or alcohol. Do you think that your own experience gave you a particular empathy or an insight into her own battle?
Yeah, I didn't know that I could do, you know, I was on drugs for many years up and through Precious, and then I stopped, and then I was drinking, and I didn't really, you know, there's a thing that there's a shot at the end of every night when we're shooting a movie called the Martini Shot that Alfred Hitchcock made up. And it was because it was a rough day. You had that last shot, you have your martini. And there were no martinis on this set. There were no martinis. And going into production on a film is like going to war. It really requires every cell of your body working. I didn't even know that I knew how to do it. You know, that martini's like a warm coat around you to protect you from the crazy that's going on outside.
Yeah.
And it was really hard for me to do. I'm really proud of myself.
Yeah, good.
And
for you,
I'm
man.
Saying it to my other brothers out there struggling, you can do it too.
Absolutely. And it strikes me that there's a lot of aspects of Billie Holiday's life that probably parallel your own, not just the addiction, but she was a victim of horrific abuse as a child. You've talked openly about suffering physical abuse at the hands of your own dad when you were young. You are openly gay. The movie addresses sexuality and sexual discrimination. Do you always look for some kind of personal connection to the movies you make?
I have to, otherwise I don't understand how to tell those stories. Yeah. Each story that I've told, every from the Butler on, Empire and Monsters, all these movies are characters and people that live in me or that I intimately know. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to tell stories that are not intimate to my experience.
And in terms of dealing with LGBT issues in this movie, Billie mm-hmm. Holiday was fairly well known to be bisexual. And she was, of course, friends with the movie star Tallulah Bankhead, which in those days, saying someone was a friend of Tallulah was basically sort of the lesbian equivalent of saying they were a friend of Dorothy, I guess. And there's also an interesting side character in Billie's longtime makeup artist, this fella named Miss Freddy. This is the kind of character that might often get overlooked in a biopic, but he gets a good chunk of screen time here. What drew
it's
you
not
Miss
a biopic.
Freddy?
It's not a biopic.
Oh, right. We're not calling
it's
it a biopic.
It's an espionage love story.
An espionage love story. Okay. What drew you to Miss Freddy? Maybe even you were inspired as a gay man by his story.
I loved Miss Freddy. And I just thought that, you know, when I think of my growing up, there was always a Miss Freddy. And my mother knew a Miss Freddy. My grandmother knew a Miss Freddy. And we never see Miss Freddy on screen. Mm-hmm. We never see a Miss Freddy on screen. And I love that Billie embraced, she didn't judge. She had all sorts of people around her. And I wanted to give life to and breath to this character that we've never seen before on screen.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll return with more when we come back in just a moment. You chose the singer Andra Day for the role of Billie Holiday, and she mm-hmm. just does a brilliant job, but this was actually her first acting role. By all accounts, including hers, Andra could not be more different than the woman she portrays in this movie.
I know.
She doesn't drink or do drugs, doesn't have sex, isn't wild, doesn't even cuss, apparently.
And then she met Lee Daniels.
Yeah, you corrupted this poor girl.
Poor thing. You look at Billie Holiday, you look at her, they're completely the opposite people, and yet they are the same mm-hmm. in that they are Black women that understand what it's like to be a Black woman and a singer. And there was something spiritual about her that I saw when we sat down. And I sent her to an acting coach and I sent her to a vocal coach. And the acting coach sent me this, didn't unbeknownst to Andra, she videotaped Andra getting into a character as she was going to go to the audition for me. Huh. And I saw a metamorphosis. I saw Andra turn into Billie. And it wasn't, she hadn't spoken a word. She hadn't even began the scene yet. But the physical characteristics, the voice, the vacant look in her eye, I knew that that was God speaking. And
really?
I knew I had to, I knew I had to hire her. I would be going against the universe if I didn't hire her.
Wow, that's quite a justification for your casting choices there, for sure. I thought she was just terrific. Apparently, I read that she lost 39 pounds for this role. That's incredible.
Yeah,
wow.
She did.
That's some Robert De Niro stuff right there.
Since she wasn't an actor yet, she hadn't acted. I don't think she knew. And she didn't, you know, she gave it her all. So she didn't know that she needed to, you know, well, what happens after the movie? So I think she just committed. She committed and she trusted me. She really, you know, oftentimes actors get burned because they're working sometimes with not so great directors that, you know, they give their all and then they see this edit that's sort of badly put together and they're not so trusting the second time go round or the third time go round.
Yeah.
But Andra trusted me and it was, you know, we jumped off the cliff together for sure.
It sounds like it. Again, just an incredible performance. I believe she got a nomination for a Golden Globe.
Globe nom. Yeah, man.
Wow.
And a song,
first time
too.
Out.
I'm
Good
really excited
her.
About that.
How much of the attraction was that she is a singer? So, you know, you don't have to do that usual thing where you have a movie star lip syncing someone else's voice.
Well, outside of her being a phenomenal singer, she sang at the Academy Awards right before I hired her. I was thinking strongly about it. I'd seen that video. And then I saw her perform at the Academy Awards. I was like, nope, this is the girl. because she just like, you know, again, that was God talking. The first thing we did was we used her voice in the pre-records before we began shooting. So before we even began shooting, we used her singing all of the songs, but she dropped into a place of Billy that I didn't even understand. So that, and as we were learning and as the script was evolving and as we were understanding our story that we were telling, the songs, each one of them took on a different meaning. So what we initially pre-recorded, we knew we could do better. So oftentimes throughout many of the scenes, the singing scenes, she sang live. Like I believe she sang, did sing Strange Fruit live. Many of the songs she sang live and on the spot because it was so dramatically different from where we started.
Wow. Yeah. I don't think a lot of people realize this, but usually when they see someone singing in a movie, it's an actor lip syncing to a pre-recorded track just because there are so many variables that go into filming a person singing live. A lot of things can go wrong. What was the most daunting aspect of filming Andra singing live?
The producers trying to chase me around with guns. Because anything could go wrong. They were like, what are you doing? This is the biggest risk.
Right.
You know, it's dangerous to shoot it like that, but we needed to live in the moment. And I think that it was such urgency to some of the songs. And I think it worked. I mean, you hear Billy in the moment.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I actually thought that you were using original tracks of Billie Holiday.
Oh, thank you, man.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
That's a fantastic job. That's a compliment.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Now, Billie Holiday has a pretty substantial catalog of music. How did you go about choosing what songs to include and how you wanted to use them in this movie?
Well, that was Susan Laurie Parks, the writer. We knew each song is was chosen for the scene. So when she felt betrayed by her husband for going to the government or being friends with Anslinger, SLP wrote, "Let's play Solitude. I feel lonely tonight." And of course, Strange Fruit was, you know, with Strange Fruit. And Lover Man, Oh, Where Can You Be? Was when she was beaten up by Levy and she's looking out to Jimmy in the audience. So each song that we have is really based on what the scene is about.
So they all kind of correspond to emotional beats in the movie.
Yeah.
And I also, it's interesting, Strange Fruit, it's almost like the shark in Jaws. Throughout the movie, it's referenced and it's teased.
That's a good analogy, the shark in Jaws.
But it's not until the very end that we finally hear it sung all the way through. Talk a little about that decision.
It's the centerpiece of the film. And that was probably the hardest thing I've ever shot because it was shot in one shot. I was a little terrified that we'd run out of film, you know, or that the actors wouldn't be in place. You know, I understood now how football players, like what it was like to have to play professionally, you know, on a soccer team where everybody has a role to play. Because if the cross that was burning didn't go up on time, or if the kids weren't crying in a sincere way, or if the flowers, the petals that were falling off the leaves weren't, it's like it was a balancing act. And so you see her going off the bus, coming up to hearing these kids cry, and then looking at a burning cross, and then looking further to a woman hanging from a tree, and this man that's holding her holding his wife, and her wanting to throw up and running away, and there's Jimmy, and then she goes into a nearby shack, into this labyrinth of just whatever where her mind is. And I really wanted you to feel what it was like to use heroin and what it was like to see a lynching. And ultimately, you know, getting up the courage to sing the song. So that was a hard scene, man. I don't think I'll ever do that. I checked off that off my bucket list that one.
Yeah, but I like what you did with that dream sequence because I think that viewers needed to have that visceral experience of witnessing a lynching in order to truly appreciate the power of those lyrics.
Yeah, man. We were crying throughout it. We shot it. There were three takes that we used, and we ended up using the first one because everyone was so emotional in the first one. And those lyrics are still haunting me to this day. Yeah, I don't watch my movies. After I finish them, I don't watch any of them. I see them. Yeah, it's a wrap. After I caught a little bit of The Butler. It's on a Netflix. Yeah. And I got the heebies and turned it off like right in the beginning of the movie. But this one, I lived it so much. I've lived it in the edit room and then the writing stage and stuff. I just can't watch it.
Yeah, I do want to tell you that I really liked your use of various mediums throughout the film, including color film, black and white, still photos. At times, it even looks like you might be using the old three-strip Technicolor or something like that.
Bolex. I was using the Bolex too.
Okay, right. What were you looking for in terms of the look of this movie?
You know, I couldn't afford to go outside. It started from just a financial, not having enough money. Mm-hmm. I wanted to go outside in New York and really show New York City in all of its glory in the 50s. And I just couldn't. And so I ended up using stock footage. And to make that work seamlessly, I had to then incorporate it into actually the story. So it started out as a device to save me money. And then I had to, and then I said, this is sort of whack. I got to make this work as and make it a fabric of the storytelling. So I sort of dipped into, that's where that all came from. It came from not having any
Interesting.
Money.
Like so many other things.
This is what happens when you're pushed
filming out of necessity. But I
pushed it to a corner and you got to figure it out.
Right. But I loved it. I think it really added a nice texture to the film. It almost kind of reminded me of watching the old Judy Garland, The Star Is Born, where apparently they've lost certain footage, so all they have is the stills. But it's kind of a neat thing.
I love Judy Garland. I love that. I love that movie.
Oh, do you? Yeah. Isn't it terrific?
And
I read somewhere that you ended up going this indie route again because you couldn't find a studio that wanted to make the United States versus Billie Holiday. That's rather shocking to me. I mean, you're an Oscar-nominated director, terrific track record. You're making a film about a well-known music icon. What was their hesitation?
I don't know. The same hesitation that they have with Precious and Butler. And I don't know. I just think that, you know, they wanted me to make the movie. It wasn't like they couldn't get it, but they didn't want to give me the right budget to make the film. I mean, it just, you know, I hate screaming systemic racism. Just because someone's doesn't call you nigger, doesn't mean that that there's not racism in the air. Yeah. It's like an aerosol. You can't pinpoint it. And I just don't think that they felt that this movie was deserved of Hollywood, or any of my films are deserved of, because they're truth, man. These are true stories of depictions of the African-American, the American experience. Forget about the African-American, the American experience. But it's okay. I mean, I push on. I'm good. I'm old at this. I'm a old head. I've been doing this for 30 years. Bring it on, man. I'm ready to do the next one. I'm not going to complain. So a lot of these kids complain about it. And, you know, you can't complain. You got to figure it out is what you got to do.
Right. I almost wonder if you kind of like having that challenge of having to do it on your own and make those calls to, you know, there's almost an element of kind of the, not to reference Judy Garland again, I feel like this is the third or fourth time Judy Garland's come up in this conversation, but the old Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland, you know, let's put on a show thing where, you know, you're doing it by your bootstraps and all that.
I mean, you know what I found that what's refreshing is that, you know, there was a nice bidding war. And it's always been that way
on the back end,
when the film is done. Mm-hmm. So I always feel great that I'm not, because it could be worse. Like you couldn't have a distributor. So I'm really happy to have Hulu at this, you know, behind us.
You've had to grapple with the decision that many directors have had to deal with over the past year. Of course, you want to be able to see your movie on the big screen, but the reality is, who knows when theaters are going to be open again? Mm-hmm. You can't just wait indefinitely for a theatrical release. Was that a difficult realization for you?
The hardest ever. I don't know. I think I spent maybe $400,000 on film to shoot it on film. I'm one of the few films probably that were shot on film. I've shot all my movies on film. Yeah, that's a painful, man. You know, we thought it was going to Paramount. We were originally with Paramount, and then COVID hit. And if I had known that, I would have definitely put that 350 or 400 into a into another scene or three.
Right. That's a quite a good chunk of money there.
That's a chunk of money, man.
You could have used that. But I'm sure that you're eager to get it out with everything that's happened with the Black Lives Matter movement.
We didn't do this. This is before George Floyd really? Even hit the I do what's in my spirit, you know? Mm-hmm. And when I did a Butler, it was about hope because Obama was president and he was preaching that. And so it just made you feel warm fuzzies at the end of the film.
Yeah.
You know, and with this one, you could feel that bad things were happening 3 years ago, that bad things were going to happen, and it was only going to get worse. Susan Laurie Parks knew it. I knew it. We felt it. We were terrified for our sons. You know, I was on the set of Empire, my television show, and my son was 19 at the time. And I find it so strange that my son was on probation, and Taraji, who played Cookie, her son was on probation, and Terrence Howard, who's 19 also, and Terrence Howard's son, who played Lucius, his son was on probation. These kids were 19 years old in three different parts of the country. And if we weren't able to have the wherewithal to keep them out of jail, they would be in jail. You could feel what was going on in the country. So, I mean, and this is real. It's real. It's real. It's real. It's so real. It's so painful. It's real. So, and I worried about my son and my daughter. And so this movie was a call to arms. I think Billy's spirit, this was out without question, a call to arms, United States versus Billie Holiday.
Yeah. And there's almost a weird parallel here because, you know, Billie Holiday's song Strange Fruit was called the anthem of the civil rights movement. And similarly, Andra Day's hit single Rise Up has become the anthem of the Black Lives Matter movement.
What do you make of that?
It's almost as if these two events and these two women are cosmically connected, aren't they? Well, before we go, I understand that you're working on a miniseries about another music icon, Sammy Davis Jr. I'm a huge Sammy fan, and my God, the shit that poor guy had to put up with. What's your take on Sammy?
Well, I'm still trying to figure out what the take is. Mm-hmm. I'm really excited about doing it. It was based on Will Haygood. Will Haygood wrote for the Washington Post, and he created the Butler for me. And so that's how Danny Strong and I
I know Danny.
You know Danny?
Oh, yeah. He's been on the show, I think, once or twice. Yeah.
Isn't he the best?
Yeah.
That's my partner in crime.
I know.
And, you know, so Will gave me Sammy Davis. And I didn't know Sammy Davis was giving money to Martin Luther King and to the civil rights movement. And yet he was being booed off stage because he was up against Nixon. But he was up against Nixon because he couldn't come to the White House after he'd done all that work to get Kennedy in the White House, and Kennedy wouldn't invite him to come to his inaugural because he was going with a white girl.
Right.
Crazy.
Absolutely.
So
crazy.
You know, I'm really excited about telling his story. Yeah. You know, his story will focus more on the 60s, further into the civil rights movement, and a little bit, you know, well, that's going to be a biopic. For sure.
Yeah, I can't wait. Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I can't wait for that. And this film was just terrific. Once again, The United States versus Billie Holiday streams on Hulu starting February 26th. Lee Daniels, man, thanks for talking with me.
I'm coming back. Invite me back. I'll come back and talk about whatever.
And say hi to your kids.
I will.
Thanks, Lee.
Thank you very much.
Thanks again to Lee Daniels for coming on the show. Don't miss The United States versus Billie Holiday, streaming on Hulu beginning Friday, February 26. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.